You're joining We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
There you go. And that's probably the last time we'll do it for the next 2 hours, because we always forget.
The three amigos.
You can find everything about the program. You can find all the archives, contact information. If you've got sponsorship ideas or show ideas, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We are not going to fool around this afternoon.
No, we're going to get with it.
Yeah, because today we're talking about collectivism. And if you have been listening to the show for, I didn't go back and look, but I don't think we've done a program on collectivism for a very long time. And it's a topic really worth studying, especially since we get so hung up in left and right and conservative and liberal and blah, blah, blah. It's worth it to look at collectivism versus individualism. That's the other option there. So we are chatting today with G. Edward Griffin. And I believe we're all situated and he's on the line. I know this takes away everybody's fun because usually there's some kind of weird drama at the beginning. Are you with us?
Oh, I'm right with you all the way.
See, that just takes all the fun out of it.
I can hardly wait for this weird drama, though.
There's usually,
it's coming.
The phone doesn't work, or Bill's got his microphone on backwards, or I don't know, there's something. Today's like foolproof. That's a good sign. So you have been, when did you write your first book? I didn't know.
Oh, my gosh. I guess my first book was back in, I don't know. I have to look it up. It's back in the 60s sometime.
Yeah, it's been a long... you've had a really long career. Your name should be familiar to pretty much everybody. I posted online, your collectivism. It's actually a brochure. It could be printed as a brochure. So that's what people have access to, and everything else you'll have to tell them.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Yeah, I share your evaluation of the word collectivism, how important it is, and it sounds so dull, doesn't it? Like,
it actually kind of sounds like, you know, we're all going to go buy Sprouts and wear sackcloth. I mean,
let's talk about sex and violence or something. What's this collectivism stuff?
Yeah, it almost kind of waxes on that co-op thing, It sort of does.
Well, it originates with the hippies. Yeah. They had it down at the beginning, you know.
Hey, and Bill was perusing your site and learned the origins of the peace symbol last night.
Oh, yeah, we got to talk about that before we let you go. I found it really interesting where the whole peace symbol originally came from. I think most people probably don't have a clue. We'll get to that.
Yeah, I didn't have a clue either. I remember this goes back to the 70s. Everything goes way, way back with me. But I remember when a guy who is an assistant, I can't think of his name, Ralph. I'll think of it in a minute. He worked for Dr. John Richardson, who is a friend of mine that had a practice up in San Francisco area. And anyway, he was a great researcher. He had a collection of weird books, I thought. Of course, now that's my collection. But,
sounds like all of us.
He produced this huge book. It was on symbols, you know, ancient symbols and occult symbols. It was very scholarly work. And he showed me this peace symbol. It was the origin of it. And he said, this is, as you can see, it's got the satanic origin in it, all the things we were talking about in this thing. And I really had trouble with it because I didn't want to believe that so many people would be using a symbol that had these nefarious origins. But boy, I checked into it, I looked in some other references, and sure enough, it was true. So, it's a shocker to me. It was then, at least.
Yeah, Bill's reading me some of it, and it's like, yikes. Yeah. You have a lot of stuff on your website, and it's interesting because the little bio I posted about you says, G. Edward Griffin is a writer and documentary film producer with many successful titles to his credit. Listed in Who's Who in America, he's well known because his talent for researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that everyone can understand. He's dealt with such diverse topics as archaeology and ancient earth history, the Federal Reserve System, with the creature from Jekyll Island that I think probably a lot of our listeners would be familiar with, and international banking, terrorism, but you wind up getting pigeonholed sometimes. With the same thing I think we all get brushed with, you're just a conspiracy guy.
Yeah. Well, that's what Wikipedia doesn't like me.
No, I noticed that.
I think the thing that triggered it, I was okay until they discovered that I was sort of an alternative health guy. I didn't really get too enthusiastic about pharmaceutical drugs and man-made drugs for the treatment of diseases. I thought that nature had a better answer. And since when I took that tack, and especially with my book that was published in 1974, I do remember the date on that one. It was called World Without Cancer, the story of vitamin B17. Well, then they came unglued. And from that, when they discovered that, they started the first line in my biography on Wikipedia is, G. Edward Griffin, well-known conspiracy theorist,
I read that, and I was like, that won't be the biography I'll be using. I'll need to find another one.
Yeah, and of course, and I use the word repeatedly throughout, and this is a very interesting and aggravating topic to me, of course, because, you know, you don't like to have people think of you as some kind of a tinfoil hat person. That's what that phrase is supposed to trigger.
Right.
And I have no control over it. And it was very interesting because I got a letter from a lady who was actually one of the administrators and editors at Wikipedia. And she said, you don't know me, and you may not know this, but in the back room here at Wikipedia, there is a war going on over you. I said, what? Over me?
Right on.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, yeah, to make a long story short, there were some editors there, you know, just very sincere, dedicated people, and they came across my biography, and they said, well, here's another one of those wackos, and they started to check out what I'd read, and they said, well, no, this isn't wacko at all. This is good stuff. It's backed by science, and they started to challenge it. Well, that started a war in the back room of Wikipedia. I guess it still goes on because the word or the phrase conspiracy theorist is still there.
Yeah,
but
it was there
anyway.
Yesterday.
Yeah, if you'll notice in Wikipedia, and that's not our topic today, but if you notice, anybody in the alternative health field is described as a wacko. So that should be a sign right away, a clue that there's something not right going on at Wikipedia.
Yeah. Well, and then you threw down and you had another conference in Arizona refuting, what was it, global warming?
Oh, yeah, oh, global warming, inconvenient lie.
An inconvenient lie, yeah.
Inconvenient lie.
It was a great title.
Sort of a subtle thing, you know, a subtle title.
What was it about?
Well, it was, let me think.
Yeah, so you've weighed in on a lot of things that they're going to love to hate. So we should give people your website is freedomforceinternational.org. It's spelled all spelled out. freedomforceinternational.org. And I'll tell you what, that is a wealth of information. You've got some really good video on there and just a ton of research. So very much appreciate that. And we have that posted, but in case I forget to give it out. So let's see, Bob, what do you think? Should we take a really swift break so we don't wind up behind the whole time?
And sounds like a novel idea.
Yeah, I know. We never do that. And then we will launch into collectivism with our friend G. Edward Griffin. Be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Damn, Bob, I told you not to bring up my past.
They're an honor of our peace symbol. Good one. Mr. Griffin, you have to just forgive us. We can't help ourselves.
Well, that's okay. I'm not an old hippie. I wish I were. I think the hippies had a lot of fun, but I missed all that.
So did they, really. Most of them don't remember much.
Yeah, I was working hard, and they were having fun. I was jealous.
Yeah, it was chaos, I think. It looks like chaos anyway.
Yeah, well, that's why you're writing books, and I'm talking to you about them.
I was a kid. What do I know? Oh, funny. All right, so where would you like to start with collectivism?
Start with collectivism, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, where do you start with that? I guess I'll just have to tell you a little bit about my story of why it's so important to me now and now to a lot of people. You know, I've been in this battle for, let's just call it what I consider it to be a battle for freedom, since about 1960s when I first discovered that we had a problem in the world, and particularly here in America. I was raised like most people, especially at my age. I was raised, you know, America was all apple pie and motherhood and patriotism and all of the good things. And I still have that feeling and that great feeling of love for my country and my countrymen. But I began to be aware that something was wrong among the leadership level, that I began to suspect that our leaders were more like con artists than real statesmen and, you know, real Americans. I began to realize that they represented ideas which were different from what our founding fathers had. And I was never much of a student. You know, to me, going to school was punishment for being young. And I had to learn. I had to read books, and I hated it. I wanted to just have fun. And so when I came out of school, it's good that I had been such a lackluster student. I got grades were okay, probably B's and B pluses and so forth. But I, you know, mostly I took all the easy courses I could, so I didn't have to work too hard. All of that, and you know, I really studied girls more than anything. And so I was lucky when I came out of all that that I hadn't really been a student because I didn't have an awful lot to unlearn. But I did. I did know enough to realize that there was something fishy going on at the highest levels, and it seemed like it was contrary to the American tradition. So it's kind of triggered my curiosity, and, well, I went back too far, you know, on this. Let's fast forward to the realization that all of the problems that I could see in the world today were based not on the fact that there were evil men in positions of office, but because of what these men believed. It was something they believed in, and to them it really wasn't evil. Maybe in some cases it was. Here you get psychopaths in office, but I realized that a lot of these evil men that people were talking about being evil really thought of themselves as being high on the high road. They had a goal that was different than mine, and I became curious about what was this goal. And so I found out, and I began to read all of the works of the great leaders of the totalitarian movements of our age. I became interested in Marx. Of course, everybody had to read a little bit about Marx, but I got really into it. And, you know, Lenin and Khrushchev and all of them. In fact, I remember when I was in Los Angeles and working for a large insurance company, I was climbing that corporate ladder and all of that. But I remember I went down to the communist bookstore in Los Angeles. It was called the People's Bookshop. Everything was the people this, the people that, and so forth. It was down in Larchmont Street. And I met the comrades down there, and they kind of took a liking to me. They thought they were going to recruit me into the party. You know, I was a little different than that. They were more on the hippie side that we were talking about before, but not all of them. And they had some very normal people there and some very high-level people, but here I came in as a young corporate type. You know, I had a suit on and a narrow tie and had the sideburns. You know, I had to wear them in those days. And they thought, here's a guy interested. So they tried to recruit me, and they invited me to what they call their study groups, who were really the wide end of the funnel to bring you into the party. So I went to their study groups, and I, you know, discussed these things. I got all the books from from Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, and I read Karl Marx, you know, Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto and all that.
You got them all. Like,
wow.
Oh, yeah, all of them. You should see my library. In fact, when I've got a pretty good library, and I started, unfortunately, with some of that crap. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. But I read them all, you know, and I had to realize that there was an underlying appeal if you weren't too critical. You know, the slogans are great. You know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. What's wrong with that? You know, isn't that the basis of charity? And, you know, workers of the world unite against the forces of fascism, racism, and war, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And if you just listen to the slogans, you got to sign up. You just have to go. Anyway, so I read all that stuff, and I think probably I got to know more of it than the guys that were teaching the class because they were a little bit shallow on that stuff. But then I got interested in what I thought was, initially I thought it was the opposite of communism, and that was Nazism and fascism. So, you know, naturally you go to the works of all the great fascists. And Adolf Hitler was, of course, the most notable one. You read his Mein Kampf. And then, you know, later on you read the little red book from Mao Zedong. And so I was reading all this stuff. And this library of mine, I'd mentioned it before, my little kids would come along and I'd see them looking at my library. And I realized I had a lot of books that really I didn't believe in. So I had to point out to the kids, I said, now that shelf down there, those are the bad guys down there. And the ones up here, these are the good guys. And the kids came in, and they were little kids. And they said, oh, is this a bad guy book or a good guy book? Well, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, you know, if you're a little kid. So here I go wandering again, but this is my background. So you asked for it. This is what's
That's okay.
Out.
That's what we do.
Yeah, that's what we do when we talk about ourselves, a terrible thing. Well, anyway, to cut to the chase, after I got through all of this stuff, it subconsciously began to be aware that there was a commonality to it all. And I started to make a list of the things that were the same. And after this is a 2 or 3 year project on my part. It wasn't something I just sat down and decided I was going to do. It just sort of happened in my spare time. And at the end of this 2 or 3 years, I had this list, and I thought, my gosh, there is no difference between them except the names of the authors. There were commonalities to all of these things, and that, when I got it all together, is what I realized was what the old writers called collectivism. And that I discovered that all of these things like communism, socialism, fascism, Nazism, left-wingism, liberalism, you know, New Dealism, all these words come into our vocabulary throughout history. But if you peel off the label and you look underneath, they are all the same. And some of the more scholarly authors of 100 years ago referred to that as collectivism. And so I started to go to the encyclopedia. We didn't have the internet in those days. You actually had to go down to a thing called the library. It was a big building, and they had books in it.
And that was our high school excuse for leaving the house. Are you kidding?
Yeah, good excuse to bug it out. But I never went to a library in my life unless I had an exam coming up, you know. And all of a sudden, I found myself could hardly wait to get back into the library and to look up these things. And I was embarrassed to tell my friends that I was doing this, but nevertheless, that was what was going on. And so I started to read, and I found out that there was an old literature that goes back, 100 years now. It was only 70 years when I started this, or 60 years now. So many more years have been added to it. But in our modern world, we've forgotten the word collectivism, and we've forgotten that collectivism has a constructive opposite to it, and it's called individualism. So finally, okay, that's the background, how I discovered these words and began to find the old books that had them in it. And I found out that the so-called bad guys, the Adolf Hitlers and the Khrushchevs and the Stalins and the Lenins and, you know, all of these people, they did use that word, by the way. They did, even though they're more in modern times. They knew exactly what it was. And then I got into the the think tanks in America, the Carnegie Endowment Fund for International Peace and the Ford Foundation, and I found that they had major projects back 50, 60, 70 years ago, and they used the word collectivism with great precision. They knew exactly what it meant, and they said, we must create collectivism. We must create an American appreciation for collectivism. We must teach collectivism in the schools. They used this word over and over again. I remember I read them years ago, and I didn't know what it meant. Now I had a little better understanding. They said, we must convince the students that collectivism is the wave of the future. It was one of the phrases that kept showing up. And we must control education in America so that students come out at the other end with a loyalty and a love for collectivism, and they must get rid of this thing called individualism, which served its purpose in history, but now it is a thing of the past. This is the kind of thing that I kept running across. Well, okay, you can be sure I got very interested at this point in finding out what is collectivism, what is individualism. So all of that is background. Now we come to the real thing, with what is it? This commonality to all of the socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, and so forth. Well, I made a list of ideas that I found common to them all. And there were many, but there were actually about eight or seven, I guess, that kept, they were really at the top of the list. And so I tried to codify them. I tried to narrow it down to, like, thesis sentences, you know, condensed, so that the essence would be there. All the fat would be stripped away, but the muscle would be there and the bones would be there. And I came up with the eight things that now are in what we call the creed of freedom in Freedom Force. It's the things that individualists believe. And what that all is about is that all of the great debates, the so-called political debates of our time, when people have these heated disagreements over we should do this or we should do that, I found out that you can, if you strip off the words, it is a debate between the ethics of collectivism versus the ethics of individualism. All of them in the Western world. Now, you get in other parts of the world and you have theology, you know, theocracies. People say, well, a government should be based on religion. It should be based on our concept of God. And that's why many of the pilgrims escaped Europe. They came to America to get away from that. And right now we see that concept in many parts of the Middle East and so forth. So there are parts of the world that still the debate is over, you know, theocracy, the role of religion and the marriage of religion and the state. But in the Western world, it's over ideology other than that, and that is all of it is in this debate between collectivism and individualism. Now, one more preface, and that is that I discovered that most, if not, well, almost all of the people in both camps are more in agreement than they realize. Most of them, all of them, I like to say, really want the same thing. They want good things in their minds. They want peace, prosperity. They want health. They want work. They want health. Yeah, I said health, but they want education. You know, all of the good things, they want them. Where they differ is how to get them, and that is the core of the whole. One of the core of the whole thing between collectivism and individualism. The collectivists want to bring it about by force, and the individualists want to bring it about by persuasion and freedom of choice and that kind of thing. Now, that's one of the eight things. So having said that, now let's go to do you want me to continue with this, or do you want me to take a break?
No, let's continue with it, but let's take a quick break first.
Okay, so we don't thought I'd used up a lot of time.
No, no problem. That way we don't have to interrupt you right in mid-sentence.
Okay,
we will be right back. You're listening to G. Edward Griffin discuss collectivism versus individualism. So for all of you out there who feel like a square peg in a round hole, today's the day you feel totally normal. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I just got out my little red book the minute that you said goodbye.
Bob's hooked on the peace symbol.
We're going to burst his bubble later.
he's taking us back to the 60s. Well, I was born in 1961, so my entire education was shaped by all these people who were hippies. And I have to say, there were some church, like retreat type things, and they always wanted us to talk about, you know, how our parents oppressed us, and didn't we want to, you know, like break out and do bad things or whatever. And I was the oldest of five kids, and we were a really tight-knit family, so they always keyed on me. What's wrong with her? Because they wanted us to know, they wanted us to tell them what was wrong with our parents. You know, what were our parents doing to us? You know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, I don't know. My parents aren't doing anything. They're just regular.
It's what I'm doing to them.
And it was like, oh, she's got really big problems. They'd say, you're repressing it. That was the first time I heard the word repressed. What a bunch of loons. And these were people who were, you know, my dad was big on individualism,
That was back in the Dr. Spock days.
Exactly. And they wanted us to, you know, all be part of this. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it was never my deal. And so I always was the bad seed. So thanks for legitimizing my childhood, Mr. Griffin.
Well, that's nice. You know, I think all kids have this feeling that they're being repressed and oppressed by their parents. And if their parents are doing a good job, they probably should feel that way at times, because at least I'm speaking for myself, because as a kid I had impulses to do a lot of things that would have been bad for me. It would have been bad for the family. It would have been bad for the community and everything.
But we all knew that was wrong. I mean, I wasn't going to tell somebody my parents were oppressing me because they wouldn't let me stay out till midnight when I was in the sixth grade. Yeah. I mean, that just makes me sound like an idiot.
Well, plus your parents had a lot of oppression tools that they had at their disposal, too, that kind of kept you in line.
Well, I don't know. It was just regular, you know. I mean, those of us who grew up in kind of regular households, the 60s guys, the collectivist guys who wanted us to look at the world and everything was about the world and all that kind of stuff, when we were being raised by people who, you know, were trying to help us become individuals, that was all very weird.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things that you don't think about when you're kids, and at least I got to keep changing it, that I never thought about when I was a kid. I think it was fairly normal in that regard. I know with our family, I used to take advantage of the fact that the kids got hungry several times a day, and they had to come together and sit around a table. And so I nailed them. That was the time to talk, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You can eat your food fast if you wish, but you can't leave the table.
Right. that was our house.
And so, well, why can't? Well, because we got to talk. Well, what are we going to talk about? Well, I don't know. Let's find something interesting to talk about. What do you want to talk about? And if they wanted to talk about the latest movie or something, it was fine. But they had to talk about something, and we tried to steer it a little bit into worthy topics. So anyway, they survived pretty well, actually. I'm very proud of my kids, and I'd like to think that requirement that we work together a little bit as a family, at least over meals, you know, I'd like to think and talk about things and other than, you know, what do you want to buy?
Right.
I think it had a good influence on them. So.
Well, that's as close to collective as I think most of us got.
Yeah.
Little did we know.
Yeah. You know, so we get back to this thing, collectivism. I'm looking at my list, and I've got number two here, which is called the supremacy of the individual. I sometimes think I should put that at the top.
Yeah, that's a biggie.
Because that's really the biggest one of them all. So do you want me to go into these, or should we?
Oh, no, definitely
do.
Yeah,
this is the creed of freedom, correct?
Yeah, the creed of freedom, yeah, number two. I'm going to put it up at number one for today, at least. The heading is the supremacy of the individual. And it's short, so I'll just read it. It says, I believe that one of the greatest threats to freedom is to allow any group, no matter its numeric superiority, to deny the rights of the minority. And that one of the primary functions of a just state is to protect each individual from the greed and passion of the majority. Okay, you know, that's there's the essence of it, because the word collective and collectivism and individualism says it all. The collectivists believe that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. You know, I was taught that in school, and when I heard it, I thought, that sounds pretty good, the greater good of the greater number. Isn't that good? Well, sure, it's good, but again, how do you achieve it? You know, the greater good of the greater number, I discovered, is to protect the rights of the individual. That's how you produce the greater good of the greater number. But if you sacrifice for the individual, for the group, you've made a big mistake, because, first of all, the group doesn't even exist. There's no such thing as a group. It's a word. It's an abstraction in the mind. You can't touch a group. You can't see a group. You can only see individuals. That's all that's real. A group is like a mathematical concept. It's in the mind. It's like the word forest. There's no such thing as a forest. There are trees, yeah. You can touch trees, you can see trees, but when you touch or see many of them, you say, oh, that's a forest. But the word forest is an abstraction. It doesn't really exist. It's
that's
a mathematical
true.
Thing. So when you say that the group, which is an abstraction, has rights that are superior to the individual, which is real, boy, what a terrible error you've made, because you've set in motion a situation where there are demagogues that come along, or politicians with great rhetoric, and they will convince you that they represent the group, and they will make decisions on behalf of the group, and the group is more important than the individual, so therefore you are an individual, and you can be sacrificed, if necessary, for the group. And boy, there's the beginning of all of the mischief right there. All of the great crimes, political crimes of history, at least in modern history, you know, the genocides, the wars, the false flag attacks, everything is that, well, it's pretty good because, you see, it was necessary for society. We have to sacrifice this person or these thousands of people or this million people. We have to sacrifice them for the greater good of the world or something like
that. When in reality, it was just the will of one individual.
It's the will of one individual or a small group of people.
Sure, or imposed on the group.
Yeah, and all they got to do is just say, well, we're doing this because it was for society, you know. We can't allow you to let your child go unvaccinated, even though you don't think it's right, even though the scientific evidence is that we're probably actually hurting the kid rather than helping him. In spite of everything, we say that vaccines are good, and therefore, if for the greater good of the greater number, your kid has to be vaccinated, come hell or high water, or else you go to prison, you see. That's collectivism in action.
Mm.
So, anyway, that's one example. So that's under the heading of the supremacy of the individual. It's a very important concept. You know, I speak of the group. You know, take a lynch mob, for example. Now, there's only one dissenting vote.
Typically.
So if you really go along with the greater good for the greater number, what's wrong with a lynch mob? What's wrong with this thing called democracy, you see? Oh, my gosh, this means you have to start thinking for a change. You can't just go along on slogans. You've got to dig a little bit deeper. And you find out, you come to this very interesting discussion that you sometimes hear about, the differences between a democracy and a republic. You know, what is that all about? Well, this is what it's all about. In a republic, a classical definition of the word republic, in today's world, the word republic doesn't mean anything.
No, that's a dirty word.
Yeah, we got Republic of China, you know, the Republic of Soviet Socialist Republic, you know, that called republic in today's world doesn't mean anything. But back in the days when our Constitution was written, the word republic had a very strong central meaning, and that was a constitutional form of the state in which the Constitution was written with statements that were designed specifically to protect the individual against the group.
Hmm.
Think about that. To protect that guy at the end of the rope. All right, he's only one, but this is not a mathematical concept, folks. This is a matter of individual rights versus group rights. You see, the individual, no matter what the crime, is entitled, according to the Constitution or bylaws or whatever you want to call your document, your statement of agreement that you've all agreed that this is the kind of a system we want to live under, the individual has a right to fair trial. And the fair trial is defined as A, B, C, D, and E, and so forth. It's all spelled out, things that the group cannot do against the individual. That's the whole nature of our Bill of Rights, is, you know, Congress shall pass no law restricting the right of freedom of speech. That means the group represented through Congress, even though the group elected the congressman and that's the representative of the majority, I don't care, the document says, the group shall not pass a law restricting the right of freedom of speech, peaceful assembly, the right to religion, and so forth. The group shall not do this. There's the difference between a republic and a democracy. It's a very important difference. And boy, when you're designing a state or society in which you want to live in, you better get it right, because you're going to, you know, if you don't have it right, you're going to live in slavery.
Well, it's interesting. I think people have gotten some decent education here since the election in the difference between a democracy and a republic when you start looking at the outcome of the vote. You know,
well,
half of the popular vote lives in 57 of the 3,100 counties in the U.S. So, yeah. So do you want to let 57 counties pick your next?
Yeah. Do we want to go to mob rule? Because
yeah,
that's what it'll be.
Does that really represent everyone? Is that really half? Kind of.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, because most people, as you say, don't get it. They think, oh, well, Hillary got the majority vote, so then she, winner takes all. See, that's the idea that people have now, not only in America, but around the world. If you can just win the election, you get it all, you know?
Well, I'm waiting to go all the way to the new philosophy where nobody loses, you know, because now everybody gets a trophy. So we'll have an election and they'll both be presidents.
Yeah, everybody gets a trophy. Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
participation. They participated.
Yeah, we had an election, but they were in it, so you know they can both run it.
Well, you see, when the Electoral College was created, it was understood that they did not want the populous states to dominate the less populated states. There again, the idea of protecting the individual or the minority against the majority. It was a very important concept.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, so many people don't understand the principle and the effect the Electoral College has on our elections. And, you know, now they're all screaming
in
a good way.
Yeah.
And they're all screaming, oh, we need to get rid of it because it's not a true reflection of what people want. Well, if you want, the major population centers in the country to make all the rules, get rid of it, because that's exactly what will happen. We talk about no representation.
Yeah, and that would truly be the collectivist answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's collectivism, and let's face it, we live under collectivism. And my only bone of contention with some of my friends on this issue is they say, we live in this is a republic, not a democracy. And I say, no, wake up, smell the coffee. We live in a democracy, unfortunately. We used to live in a republic, but we've allowed it to be changed. Now we live under a democracy. Wake up. Now we got to do something about it, not just hold up the Constitution and say, I'm protected by the Constitution. No. That's not what's happening in the real world.
No, and I totally agree with you, because when it comes down to rules especially at the local level, you know, you have to have all these stupid meetings. Good Lord. You got to have all these stupid meetings with the, the bureaucrats. And everybody has to have a consensus, blah, 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 which means basically you agree with their predetermined outcome and they throw away your dissenting opinion. They scream consensus, run off and do what they want.
Yeah, that's right. It's all consensus. I hate to bring up the topic of global warming, but that was the event we had this last weekend, and the global warming theorists are always talking about, well, there's the census of
97% of all the scientists, blah, blah, blah.
And what a lie that is. But anyway, the idea that even if it were true, the idea that settles it, I mean, since when is the law of gravity, for example, or any scientific issue. Since when is that decided by how many people vote for it?
Right.
And really, yeah, when is science settled?
Well, the concept of science being settled means it's not going to be science.
Yeah.
It
means we have all the answers.
The only time they want to make a debate illegal, and that's what the global warming theorists are doing now, they're trying to pass laws so that you can't even discuss an opposing point of view anymore. They're going to call you a denier and put you in prison.
That's right.
Only time that an issue needs the force of law to defend it is when it's a lie. You know, the truth doesn't need that.
Right.
So, and there, well, I went.
Yeah, we get flashbacks to blasphemer. Yep. might as well just start burning them as heretics. Yeah. It's coming.
Get a box of rocks. Yeah. You need them.
Anyway, we'll. but we digress. Take one more quick break here, and we're going to come back with G. Edward Griffin. We're chatting about collectivism, in case you hadn't figured that out yet. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That ought to be a familiar song to my dad. In our individual paradise, yes, we had a lot of discussion about what to do.
Yeah, but there was a limited amount of voters.
Yeah, my dad had pretty much a monarchy going on there.
You know that song. If I think I heard the words correctly, "Don't tell me what to do."
Yeah, pretty much.
The line? Boy, that couldn't have been a better lead-in to the third principle in the Creed of Freedom, which is freedom of choice. You know, how do we determine to bring about this greater society, the better society? How do we bring it? Do we bring it to be by laws and the power of coercion, or do we bring it into being through education, the power of example, the good example, persuasion, and that kind of thing? Because you can't find a more clear distinction between collectivists and individualists than that. Both groups, they want the same thing, but the individualist says, okay, let's go persuade people to do it. We want to keep freedom of choice. But the collectivist says, nah, they won't do it. They won't do it. They'll make mistakes. So we have to force them. We have to pass laws. I have a friend, a good friend of mine. I jokingly call him the Kraut because he's of German origin, and very affectionately call him that, by the way. This is not an insult, everybody. Don't get excited.
we had neighbors that were Germans.
Don't start sending emails.
We always referred to him as the Nazi, but he liked it because he was a Nazi.
Back in the day, he was in the Hitler Youth.
Well, this guy is a Kraut, too. I mean, he got a lot of typical characteristics. That he's very strong-willed, like I am. I mean, I'm kind of a Kraut myself. But anyway, so he's classic because if he sees something he doesn't like there's a cigarette butt that he sees somebody throw onto the street. He says, there ought to be a law. There ought to be a law against it. No matter what it is, how serious or how harmless it is, there ought to be a law, because in his mind, people, if they're not forced to do it, they're not, a lot of them aren't going to do it. So we can't allow freedom of choice. Well, there's a clear-cut distinction between collectivism and individualism. If you don't allow people to make a mistake, if you say that the group can pass laws to force everyone, including yourself, yep, to do what the group thinks is best, then you've given up your liberty. You've lost it right then and there.
And they don't, and, you know, they don't see anything wrong with it when it seems to be going their way, and yet you gotta realize it. It could go sideways on you in a minute. So okay,
well, it always does. It's not that it could. It always does.
Yes, eventually, sure.
Eventually, yeah.
All right. So
and
the $64,000 question here is: are you going to come back with us after the break and do the other pillars or the other?
Oh, you know the answer to that.
All right. Hey, we got somebody who wants to hear about communitarianism as well. So I think we're talking about that now, but we'll touch on that when we come back.
We'll be right back with J. Edward Griffin, our hostage for the second hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Changed my volume so much and I can't hear anything. There we go. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Yep.
Look at this. We're like a well-oiled machine.
I know it. We're downright slippery in here.
Exactly. You can find all of the information about the program, sponsorship ideas, contact Bill or contact me with ideas, you know, ideas for shows, ideas for things we should be looking into, maybe guests, if you've heard a great interview, read a really good book, shoot that to us. We'd like to have it. You can contact us at wethepeopleradio.us. And now, without further ado, we're going to zoom right back to our guest, G. Edward Griffin, who you've probably heard of. And unless you've been living under a rock, I'm sure you read The Creature from Jekyll Island a long time ago. Or maybe recently, you never know. With all the stuff that's happened in the last 8 years, books like that have become much more on the forefront, I think.
That book was so far ahead of its time.
It's, all of a sudden, it's
happening.
Popular again.
Yeah.
Edward, help me. A World Without Cancer?
Yeah, that's the 1974 book.
Perfect. I didn't have it in front of me, and they didn't want to read the title incorrectly. I need to read that one. I'm not familiar with that one. I'm familiar with writing about it that you have done, but not the book itself. Any others you'd like to plug while we're?
Well, those are the two
kind of
most popular
split.
Ones right now. And since you said the word plug, that reminds me, my staff is always telling me to plug our website. So
yes, please.
I always forget to do that. In addition to freedomforceinternational.org, which you mentioned before, which is my favorite site because it's where we don't have anything to sell except ideas. But we do have a commercial site. It's called realityzone.com. And there we've got books and recordings, videos and audio recordings. We've got over 100 items that are dealing with topics like we're discussing today. And they're really hot topics. So if you want to, you know, see where our documentation comes from and our sources and all that, that's where you go, to realityzone.com.
Cool. I will. I got to that through Freedom Force International, but I'll post that as a link as well.
Yeah, the Freedom Force International site's what I was on last night, and boy, it's got some good information there.
On any topic, pretty much, you throw a dart, you'll hit it. Very nicely done too, and things you can print out like the collectivism brochure. Don't argue with your friends or family. Just print the brochure. It's four little paid, you know, sides, and you could be in and out of the argument before you know what hit them.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. Yeah. If we were collectivists, we would say no.
You must print the brochure.
We're going to strap you into the chair and pry open your eyelids until you agree with us.
Exactly. We will make you
believe. No, that's what the collectivists do, actually, and in one way or another. And, the perfect example is seatbelts. That always comes to mind. You know, we all agree that seatbelts are a good idea. The collectivist says seatbelts are good. If you don't wear seatbelts, you're apt to get killed or somebody will get killed. Therefore, let us pass a law. And if you don't wear seatbelts, you dummy, we're going to fine you or put you in prison. And the individualist says, yeah, I agree. Seatbelts are very important, and I wear them and so forth. But I believe that people should have the freedom to wear them or not. Now, if you want to browbeat your kids and say, all right, you put your seatbelt on, that's something else again. But in a free society with adults, you can use the power of example. You know, look, I put my seatbelt on. You can maybe chip in some money and produce a documentary film to go on television or be shown in the schools to convince people that they ought to wear seatbelts and all of that. But the individualist says, I believe in freedom of choice. And if you don't want to wear your seatbelts or a helmet or something, well,
helmet.
But, yeah, this is a free society. Well, there it is in a nutshell.
Yeah, and they never want to do that. They always want to make you have to do it. And I get into this conversation with a family member often regarding guns, because at the end of the day, if you don't want to own a firearm, don't. If you do, why do you, the non-firearm owner, get to decide what I get to own? And the laws we make, criminals don't follow. That's why we call them criminals. So we're always making these laws for criminals who aren't going to follow them restrict the rights of the individual and the people who do use good sense and follow the law.
Yeah, well, of course, their argument is that guns are dangerous. You know, people get killed accidentally with guns. Guns are used by criminals.
You'd think that they were running around with legs.
Yeah, and my answer is, yeah, I agree. Guns are very dangerous. The only thing more dangerous than having guns is not having them.
Yeah.
That's it, you know. I mean, if that's my view. Now, if you don't agree with that, then don't have guns. That's fine. But, you know, the safest place in the world is a gun show. did you ever hear of anybody getting mugged or raped or murdered in a gun show? Yeah. I mean, everybody's got a gun in a gun show. No criminal would ever dream of doing anything wrong in a gun show.
Well, now, wait a minute. I did see a video on YouTube where security cameras picked up a guy who walked into a gun shop and tried to rob it.
I saw that, too.
Well, what happened to him?
Well, not only did the people behind the counter pull a gun on him, half the customers pulled their guns as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that makes the point, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Oh, well.
Oh, my gosh. And so now your next, if we're going to go in order, on your creative freedom, number four is one that, I got to tell you, our end of the state just deals with nonstop. Property rights.
Property rights.
Property rights. Good Lord. These people in the city always want to curtail the rural people's property rights.
Yeah. Well, what they don't realize, and I didn't realize either when I was in school, because I sort of bought into the propaganda line that, you know, it's unfair that some people should have property and others do not. So to eliminate that unfairness, we shouldn't allow anybody to have property. We'll have it owned by the community or the group. We're back to that again, to the collective. We'll own all property, which means that it'll be owned by the administrators, the bureaucrats and the politicians.
The clerks.
That's what it really means. Look in Soviet Russia, for example, or communist China, especially the days of the classical administration of collectivism there. Nobody owned anything, theoretically, but the rulers, you know, the Stalins and the Khrushchevs and so they lived like kings. There was no king of history that ever lived any better than they. It was a definite ruling class there. It was more of a class structure under collectivism than there is under classic capitalism, you know. So if you think you're going to eliminate the injustice of between the haves and the have-nots by taking away their property, you're making a big mistake because you're just making it worse. People don't realize that. But beyond that, what they don't realize and what I didn't realize was that property rights are human rights. You know, I remember reading one collectivist essay and I said, we must not place property rights above human rights, I think is the phrase. And I thought, wait a minute, Professor, let's go back over the property rights are human rights.
Yeah.
In fact, they're one of the highest form of human rights, because if you don't have the right to property, you don't have the right to be independent.
No.
You don't have any means of supporting yourself. It means you're completely dependent upon the collective. You're completely dependent on the state for food, shelter, clothing, everything, and that's where they want you. They want you right under the thumb, so that the minute you step out of line, you know, they throw the switch and you can't eat, you can't live under a roof or anything. That's what it's all about. If you take away the human right of owning property, then you have set in motion a system where everybody is a servant of the state, and that's the short way of answering all of it.
Sure. And the way they've gotten around it is they just, okay, you can own the property. That's real nice. I like this one. This is kind of the sleight of hand collectivist approach. We're gonna entice you with money and lower, how do we put it? We'll stop coming after you to regulate your property if you'll just put it in a conservation easement. Well, if you just put it in a conservation easement, it'll be good for everyone, and we'll make it worth your while.
But
what happens is you lose total control, or they're going to regulate your groundwater, or they're going to regulate your surface water, what you can do with your property. Oh, you, Mr. Farmer, you planted wheat, so you created little depressions in the ground. Some rain sat there for more than 4 seconds, so you have destroyed vernal pools. So you can't,
or created vernal pools,
or created them, and now you wrecked them.
Disturb them.
I mean, we hear this all the time, and
not only do they pay you with your own money, because it's all tax money.
It's all tax money, right? Yeah.
And then you got these regulations, so you don't really own. If you can't control something, you don't own it.
Correct.
No.
And then when you die, it has to go to the state, because nobody will, you know, you can't afford to pay an inheritance tax on it and then pay all the other taxes and all the rules and regulations. So eventually, within a generation or two, it all winds up with the state anyway.
It's a slow
method of confiscating your land.
Sure. And look at the volume of land. I refuse to call it federal land. It's supposed to be public land, but land that is under the control of the Forest Service or BLM or whatever. And we have counties, I mean, that are 70-80%, I think Trinity County is like 80% public land. Well, that's real nice, but what's the first thing that happens? Gates, you know, well, now you can't use it. It's a wilderness area, so you can't drive a vehicle on the dirt road. You can't ride a bike through it. I don't know if you're seeing it where you live, but...
Oh, but I've seen it up there in the Pacific Northwest. I spent a lot of time in Oregon, and I noticed that the lands that were getting logged off, really bare logging right down to the dirt, causing erosion, a terrible, terrible stewardship of the land, was all federal land. The private logging companies didn't dare do that because it was their property.
Right.
And they didn't want to destroy it. But public land, who owns that? Oh, to heck with it. You know, just strip it down, make the most money out of it so the bureaucracy can throw bigger parties, you know?
Well, and
they want the money.
If you come and look at it now they cut nothing, so it all burns up. So we've stopped cutting it and there are a lot of rules now. I don't think they could ever do any of those things again, but... now even management by thinning isn't being done, so it just burns up all the time. So now even your public land isn't worth anything. So they've taken it from you. You have to pay for it, and it's just going to make your life hard, especially if you live near
it. Once your eyes are open to this, it's easy to see this sort of process everywhere you look. You know, as long as you think, well, if it's government land, the government is here to help us, right?
Yeah.
You know, once you break out of that dream... Then you begin to ask questions and you realize that, no, that they're here to plunder us, not to help us.
Well, I think they're starting to wake up from the dream. You know, in California, the largest land owner in the state of California is the state of California. And therefore, they have to raise our taxes constantly in order to pay for all the stuff they want to give away. And I think people are just about done with it. Although Sacramento now wants to secede from the union, so...
You know, isn't that awesome?
They lost
Goodbye.
The election, so now they're going to pick up all their toys and go home.
If Sacramento
incredible.
Would just do that and leave the rest of the state, I think
it
would be a
I
good
hope
idea.
They do. Yeah, I hope they do.
It would be a great idea.
I know. We wouldn't have to ask them to split it. We'll just stay. You can
maybe
come up.
We sh-
You can come
maybe
up
we
here.
Should kick them out. We should kick them out of the union. Let you know.
we're just tired of their buffoonery.
We could kick them out and then take them over.
Yeah. All seriousness aside, let's.
Yeah. Right. gosh. Well, you know,
this idea of who is the best steward of the land, yes. those who own it or those who control it, it's clear. Go to any neighborhood. Let's forget the public lands now. Go to any neighborhood and you drive down the street and you see all these nicely trimmed houses with the lawns cut and everything is green and watered and it's all painted and nothing broken down. And all of a sudden you see one just completely junk. Tell me, who is the renter and who is the owner?
Yeah, in a lot of cases, it's what's the greatest fear of a homeowner? That the neighborhood converts to rentals, you know?
Yeah, yeah. If you don't own a piece of property, you don't take care of it. And this applies to all of us somewhat. I mean, I'm sorry to say, if you rent a car, you're more apt to take risks with that car driving over a curb or over a ditch or something than you would with your own brand-new car.
Yeah.
You know? It's human nature. That which you have personal identity with, ownership, we like to call it, you take care of it. You are the better steward of that land or that piece of property if you own it than if the state supposedly owns it. And if you're worried about stewardship of the land and prosperity and posterity also, I mean, what about your kids? What are they going to inherit, you know? They talk about big corporations ruining the land. Well, take a look at what big government does to the land. Take a look over there in China. Now, that's all community-owned, right? The biggest affront to the ecology, the strip mining and that sort of thing is all done by state-owned operations in China. And also, we saw that in the Soviet Union. I mean, the greatest destruction of the environment has always taken place under collectivism, not under private property at all.
That's a really good point.
Well, it's just human nature. If you think about it, it just that's a okay bingo. Next topic, you know,
yeah.
It's as simple as that. So anyway, that is point number four, and that's the difference between collectivism and individualism. Is that individualists believe that property rights are human rights, and collectivists believe that human rights are above property rights, and nobody should have personal property rights.
Yeah.
Terrible mistake.
Can you hit on communitarianism real quick? We have somebody who's
I forgot about them.
Who's wanting to discuss that?
Communitarianism is just another one of those words. Peel off the label, and what have you got? Collectivism.
Collectivism, yeah.
That's
yeah.
it. So that's another example. We got this huge list of words. They mean nothing. You have to look at the essence. How do you define communitarianism? And everything we're talking about applies to that word. It's just like, you know, liberalism or I don't know, progressivism. There's so many words that get thrown out at you and say, this is new. Well, no, it's not new. Strip off the label and look at these principles that we're talking about, and you find it's the same thing that's under fascism, Nazism, communism. Socialism.
And then don't forget, like you were saying on your website, there's all the neos now, too.
Yeah, neo-Nazism, neoliberalism, or neoconservatism, or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing except to try and confuse you to think, oh, maybe this is really different. Maybe we worked out the kinks. Maybe it'll work after all, you know?
It's the same thing.
Same thing, yep.
It'll be better this time. We'll just call it something else. It'll just be better.
And, you know, the real issue here is that most people don't think beyond the personalities of the political figures.
True.
Like in our recent elections, we're talking about, you know, Trump versus Clinton. Well, what's all the conversation about? Not much of what we're talking about here. It's all about, I hate Trump, but I hate Hillary more, or I hate Hillary, but I hate Trump more. People don't vote for anything. They vote against things lately because they have no
right.
creed of their own.
Right.
They don't know what they believe.
And you know, I think, I hope they don't figure it out, but I think they finally realize that they can't run on a platform of not liking somebody else. They have to have their own ideas, and they have none other than the same old stuff that they just keep harping on people about, and we're not buying it anymore.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, the old idea that I vote for the lesser of two evils, that's been going on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, forever. Nobody's, no, I shouldn't say nobody, but very few people are enthusiastic about what they're voting for. They're all focused on the evil of the other person, as, you know, as though the person really made a difference. The people are not important, because if they're collectivists, which most of them are, if something should happen to them, there's a huge long line of collectivists standing behind them waiting to step into their shoes. So you just go from one collectivist to the other under all these different labels, and you think, oh, we got it. It's going to be different this time. And maybe we'll get a change this time. The only thing you change is the name of the person, but the philosophy that they're operating on is collectivism. And that is why nothing changes from one election to the next, and from one administration to the next, from one party to the next. It's all collectivism underneath it.
Ew. And on that dire note, we need to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. We're chatting with G. Edward Griffin, in case you haven't figured that out. And we've been doing it for an hour and a half, so if you've missed it, go to the website and listen to the archive. I'll have it up by about in about 45 minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my give a damn's busted. I don't need you to worry for me, 'cause I'm all right. I don't want you to tell me it's time to come home. I don't care what you say anymore, this is my life. Go ahead with your own life, leave me alone.
Oh. Maybe you could get that song to play when you click on the Creed of Freedom there.
I was just thinking about that. Where do I get these recordings? You've got a great collection.
Yeah, we'll have to send it to you. Bob, Bob's over there feverishly searching through the archives of sound to come up with just the perfect thing.
Yeah, I want to get these recordings, and I'm going to tie people down and make them listen to it and learn how to not use coercion.
You know what? Let's make a law about it. Seriously. We're going to make a new law, and we're going to make everybody do it, or we're going to fine them.
I get a kick out of it. People will read some of my stuff where I preach all this, and they'll say, yeah, this ought to be required reading in schools.
You're like, oh, we're sorry. You failed. Go back to the beginning and read it again. So let's see. You want to do number five?
Well, yeah, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm thinking we're only about halfway through this. Not even halfway, so I have to speed things up and do the shorter version.
All right, we'll stop interjecting. Go on.
No, it's not your interjecting.
It is.
It's my rambling that's doing it. I know. Anyway, these are my favorite topics, you know, because at the beginning of the show, we were talking, what's so hot about this thing, collectivism? But the thing that's so hot about it is that it's the underlying motivative force behind almost everything that we don't like in our world.
Yes.
It's because people who are collectivists are running the show. And they're not doing the things we don't like. They're not doing that because they're bad people, but because they believe in the principles of collectivism, and they really think that by doing all of these things, they're making a better world for the greater number. So if we don't understand that, then we'll never be able to change anything, because we'll always be saying, well, that's a bad person. Let's just get a new name on the ballot. Let's get a new person into that position, and everything will be fine. Not so. If we don't understand what motivates these people, if we don't understand what they think, we're just going to replace one with another every time, and that's the way it's going to be forevermore. So if we are serious about bringing about real change, we have to understand the differences between individualism and collectivism. And that's where the war is. We have to win it at that level. So, yeah, that's why it's so exciting, because it touches on everything on which we have an emotional response, everything that bugs us, everything that's worrying us, everything that is injuring us. Eventually comes back to this issue of collectivism versus individualism. Well, okay, number five. The heading is Money Without Coercion. Well, that pretty well says it when you think about how does collectivism pay for itself? it certainly doesn't do it through donations from the people who are being collectivized. Nobody sends in their money voluntarily and says, here's my donation. I like what you guys are doing. I like, you know, it takes... take more control of my life. Here's here, this is all I can afford this week, but next week I'll increase my donation. No, no. Mm-hmm. No. The money has to be extracted from the people against their will.
Sure. OPM.
Yeah, other people's money. And collectivism cannot be based on honest money. When I say honest money, I mean money that is created out of gold or silver because it has intrinsic value, because then people would have to send it in. The only way collectivism can work is if the collectivists themselves create the money out of nothing. It can't wait around for people to send it in, like gold or silver or something. The collectivists have to be able to create it themselves. And that is, of course, now we're talking about the Federal Reserve System, which, you know, it happens to be one of my real hot-button topics, because the Federal Reserve and all of the central banks around the world do pretty much the same thing. They create money out of nothing. And convert it into paper currency and coins and mostly digital impulses in a computer and ink spots on a piece of paper. There's nothing behind it anywhere, gold or silver. It doesn't take any human effort to produce it, maybe a very little bit of printing a piece of paper with ink on it. But, you know, they can print a $1,000 bill for, they can do, you know, 1,000 of those for a penny or something like that. So it is a really, literally... easy to create money out of nothing if you have the laws that allow that. So, how do you solve that problem? Well, being an individualist, I cannot say that we should really pass a law that forbids that. If banks want to issue script and people want to use the script as money, I think that's probably a risky thing to do unless the bank has proven itself to be very trustworthy. But if they want to do that, as an individualist, I like to give them freedom of choice to make mistakes. And if enough people make mistakes, then you don't have to pass a law. It'll be common knowledge that this is not what you do, you know?
Yeah, bad idea.
That's how the free society works. So I'm not going to advocate a law that prohibits the very thing that I think is so bad. But what I do believe in is freedom of choice, which means I would like to give anybody the freedom to create their own money if they wish. You think, oh, that's an outrageous thought. Money has to be issued by the government, right? Wrong. In fact, the earliest money has always been issued by individuals. The dollar, for example, comes from the word thaler. It's a Dutch word. Means I think the guy's name was Schlockenthaler or something. It was some Dutchman that actually created coins, silver coins. And it was called the thaler after the man that created it. It was very high quality coin, could be relied upon for its content, and it became the dollar. The world, you know, works on the name coming from a private individual who created money. Money can be created by private individuals or institutions, corporations, anything, as long as it is accepted voluntarily by the people because it is known to be reliable. I don't care who creates it. You know, you can use Disneyland coupons, if you wish, as a money supply. If the people want to do it, that's why I think freedom of choice is the issue here. In a free society, anybody should be free to use anything they wish as a medium of exchange and not be required by law to use this and this only. It's when you are forced by law to use a particular form of exchange as money, that is when that money is apt to go bad, because then the people who are in charge of issuing it know that the people have to accept it regardless of what they do, so they start playing games with it, and the first thing you know, you have a corrupted money system or one that has no backing entirely, like what we have now. So, back to point number five, money without coercion simply means that the people should be free to choose any form of money they wish, whether it is a government-issued currency, whether it is a government-issued currency from another nation, whether it is privately issued currency, whether it is barter, whatever it is, they're free, sovereign citizens. They should be free to choose what they want. Under those circumstances, then, the forces of supply and demand and competition over a period of time, and I don't think it would be much more than about 5 or 10 years, over a short period of time, the people would decide through freedom of choice which is the best money to choose. And that, maybe two of them, side by side, will circulate as money. And from that point forward, it will be impossible to plunder the people by debauching the currency. It's a very important principle, and I think people need to really get up to speed on that one, because as long as we fund collectivism by allowing the collectivists to create money out of nothing, I don't think we're ever going to change anything.
True. True. And where do you see that going with this new batch of folks?
Well, I don't see it going. It doesn't have much much speed under it right now. Ron Paul was very clever, not clever, brilliant, when he introduced this idea several years ago. He introduced a law. Of course, it didn't get very far because nobody in Congress or the Senate wants this. But he introduced the proposal that people should be free to choose any currency they wish. And it was mostly a statement of principle and, you know, calling attention to this concept. It did get some attention, but not what it deserved. I'd like to see Freedom Force make this a major issue in the future.
Hmm. Well, let us know when you do, and we'll just blab about it for 2 hours.
Well, I just did. Let's blab. This is here. Let it be known that right here on this date at this time, this movement has been launched.
And you didn't
let it be proclaimed.
You didn't need to get a consensus to do that.
No consensus. We agree, so let's do it.
Let's make everybody read about it, huh?
Yeah.
let's force required reading.
Yeah.
This equality under the law? Because you know what? I think we're watching that hijacked in a big way, at least over the last
few years.
Equality
under law. Everybody says, yeah, I believe in equality under law.
As long as some people are more equal than others.
They turn around and they vote and support every law you can think of that is terribly unequal in that it applies differently to different segments of society. I mean, just take the income tax, for example. Well, does everybody pay the same tax? Of course not. There are exemptions and deductions all over the place. The law, the IRS, the income tax law, as I understand it, with its rules and regulations, is thousands and thousands of pages long. Nobody has ever read them all. And every page, every word in those documents is designed to make the application of the law unequal in some way. It's to give someone an advantage over everybody else. They're just an example. I mean, we have people that say, well, we should give certain groups an advantage. We should subsidize them because they are poor, or because they're old, or because they have a particular gender, or because they have a background of exploitation. Historically, their people were exploited, or whatever. I mean, there are thousands. This person is handicapped, or this person is needs an education, or this person has a certain disease. The laws are endless. They're all, up at 95% of our laws, are designed to apply the rules unequally. And everybody thinks it's a good idea to try and rectify some injustice as they see it. And then they turn around and they say, yeah, I believe in equality under the law. Well, no, they don't. I think they should. And so I think that we would get rid of most of the fraud and plunder and the corruption if we would just insist that all laws do, in fact, apply equally to every person, and regardless of the merit of their case or the strength of their argument or all of that, just equality under law. Then there's no temptation to go into politics to make a profit, because you can't use the law to shift the wealth from one group to another. And if you can't do that, then nobody's going to come to your office and offer you bribes. So, you know, it takes care of a lot of problems if we just insist on equality under the law.
Yeah, good idea. I do. I get so frustrated. They talk about equality, but then they want to make special rules for the people they consider special, and for whatever reason, people buy that. you know, I think they're getting a little tired, though, of being browbeaten. You know, every time you disagree, you're a racist or a hater or whatever.
Let's be clear. A lot of people, you know, they do have problems, and you do want to help them. But that's where charity comes in. Help these people, yes, but let's not use the coercion of law to do it, because that's where all the mischief shows up.
Well, sure. Anytime you mandate that sort of thing, it just makes it worse.
Well,
it
look
does,
at you know, the hiring, all the hiring practices. You had to have, you know, so many white people, so many brown people, you know, you had to have all that. It's kind of like how many tall people, how many short people, you know, are they the best ones for the job? Oh,
yeah,
well, we forgot about that.
Fat and skinny, blue eyes, brown eyes. Yeah, of course. And no, this is, they call it discrimination. Well, okay, what more can I say?
Yeah, it's just a backwards version of discrimination.
You have to take the politics out of it. It's the politicization of charity that leads to all of the trouble. If you get the politics out of it, people will solve these problems through freedom of choice and just human instinct to do what is the right thing. Now, not all people will do it, of course. Some will take advantage of it. But more will take advantage of the political system, because there they can do all of the same evil things but make it look like they're good people because they're advocating, you know, helping certain groups, when actually they're just dipping into the money stream for themselves.
Exactly. And a lot of that is solved by the great leader, which is your next part. But let's take a quick commercial break. It'll be our last one, and then we can hit these last two, because the great leader and the proper role of the state are super important and things we should be looking at more, I guess, more critically. We're chatting with G. Edward Griffin. We were discussing, the Creed of Freedom on his website. Bob said he would make you a list of the songs, by the way.
Oh, wonderful.
And this is one you might want to put in your Creed of Freedom. You should probably make a little, you know, like have a little button there. Are you offended? And then they push it, and it pops up, and it gives this great message. If I offend you, cry me a river. I'll bring snacks and a raft. I will literally float down your tears, eating chips and working on my tan.
Well, that offended me.
It just takes Cry Me a River to just a better place.
Yeah.
Snacks and a raft. Whoever wrote that should get a prize.
You know, sometimes the greatest lessons of your life come as a result of someone offending you and jarring you and making you think, you know. You don't learn really big lessons easily. It takes something to redirect your life. And, you know, I've had people say things to me that were terribly, I guess the word is offensive. They shocked me. I didn't like them. I rebelled against them. And I got to thinking later, you know, I must have done something wrong. What did I do wrong to create this? And I think about it and think about it. Finally, oh, that's what I did wrong. Well, hey, thanks for offending me. Now I know what not to do. So, yeah, nothing wrong with
offense. Or when you know you're right and they get offended, you're like, oh, I'm in the ballpark now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good indicator of the target, how close you are to the target.
Yeah.
So you have a really nice piece here on the great leader. And without individualism, you're never going to find a great leader because collectivism, although it does have a leader, it's not usually the great one.
Yeah, leader has a different meaning. And, I was just looking at the time remaining. I think to speed this up, I'm going to do what I don't like to do, and that is actually read things.
Talk really fast.
Yeah, I think this will get us to the point a lot faster. So this isn't too long. It's point 7 in the Creed of Freedom. It's the great leader, and here's how it goes. I believe that leadership is a natural outgrowth of human dynamics and is essential for social order and large-scale tasks. However, there are two types of leadership. One is based on coercion and decree. That's found in military organizations and totalitarian political systems. The other is based on persuasion and good example, found in voluntary organizations and free political systems. We must evaluate leaders not only on their stated goals, but on which type of leadership they offer. Their goals may be admirable, but how they pursue those goals may be tyranny. All modern totalitarian systems have a great leader who claims to represent the best interests of the people, but who is in reality merely a dictator. Truly great political leaders do not follow that path. Okay, that's it in a nutshell. And it's something to keep in mind even when we like a leader because he or she seems to be opposing someone we really hate. You know, we got to think not just, is this the lesser of two evils? Not only because, well, is there something good about this? Let's look and see if we can find something good. But what kind of leadership is this person offering? If they're saying, I will do this and I will do that, that's a very troublesome thing. If I were running for president, God help us, I would probably say, look, I'm not going to do anything because I don't have the power under the Constitution to do anything. I'm just the executive. But what I will do is try and arouse public opinion and have the people demand that their congressmen and senators do this, this, and this. I'm just the president. I'm not a king. I'm not an emperor. I don't have the power to do anything unless I'm told by the Congress. And if you doubt that, read the Constitution, folks, you know?
Right.
So I get worried when I hear people say, I will do this and I will do that. I'm thinking, uh-oh, what kind of leadership is that?
Yeah, spooky leadership. The good news spooky leader we've had for 8 years, you know, who's been creeping around doing all sorts of things, has done so much of it by executive order. Oops.
Yep, well, and that's I will do this, exactly.
And now can be undone with a different pen and a phone, so that's kind of fantastic.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, we're in the ivory tower now, right? And so we can take this high position. When you're in the trenches and the bullets are whizzing over your head, you can't always act on pure principle. I have to admit that. I know that's what people will say, and I agree with that. But anyway, we're talking about what is the ideal? What should we be working toward? What do we believe in? So this is our goal. All right. Not much really to say beyond that. And so let's move to number 8. And this is probably the second most important one of the whole bunch. And that is the proper role of the state. And the reason I say it's so important is because, like any set of rules and philosophical statements, you can always find gray areas. It's clear on maybe 97% of issues, but what about this? What about this? Oh, this is a tough one, you know, because the rules, it's not clear cut. So you have to have an overriding philosophy that guides you in the gray areas. And this is it. We have to have a view of what is the purpose of the state. I used to call it the government. I used to say, what's the proper function of government? And then I realized that was a stupid thing to say, because by using the word government, I have salted the answer. What is the purpose of government? Well, it's to govern. Well, wait a minute. That's not what I want. Most people don't want to be governed. What do they want the state to do? Govern them? Not really. At least individualists don't. We want the state to protect us. That's what the original the founding fathers created, the original document of the Constitution, not to govern us, but to protect us. Actually, what the United States was, it was not a government, but a protectorate. Didn't use that word. I wish they had. But if you analyze the purpose of the Constitution, it was not to govern the people, but to protect their lives, liberty, and property. And that was pretty well spelled out in the, you know, the Declaration of Independence. To protect the lives, liberty, and property of the citizens was the purpose of this new state they were creating. So I changed it from government to state. So the proper role of the state, what is it? Well, it's not to govern us. It's to protect us. And there you have the essence of it. It's to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens, nothing more. In other words, it's defensive in nature. It's not creative. It's not the great leader. We're not going to take care of them and teach them and provide education and housing and jobs and charity and pay their rents and fix their plumbing or anything like that. It's just to protect them. Now, why? It's because the state derives its power from the people, in at least the ideal system. We don't advocate that the state be based on conquest. Somebody comes in with a greater army and overcomes our state, and now we are subject to a new conqueror. No, we believe that the state should derive its just powers from the governed, or from the, not, there's that word again, from the citizens. And so what do citizens have the right to use force for? We have a right to use coercive force, even to kill, for certain things. What are they? Well, to defend our lives. Nobody would complain, or very few would complain, that we killed somebody because they were trying to kill us. You know? So we have a right to use coercion in defense of our life. What about our liberty? If somebody's trying to enslave us, we have a right to fight to the death to preserve our freedom. So, okay, the right to defend our life, our liberty, and what about our property? Well, most people have that instinct. You know, you've created something, you've worked all your life for it, and you've got something. It's your land or whatever it is, maybe something you built, and somebody tries to steal it from you, you have a right to defend your property. So there you have it. We have the ethical right to use coercion against our neighbors only in the defense of life, liberty, and property. If that's all we can use coercion for, then that's all we can delegate to our elected representatives. We cannot tell our neighbor that he has to close his shop on Sunday. We cannot tell our neighbor what he has to teach his children.
Yeah, he didn't build that business.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Somebody had to include that.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. Maybe he did, maybe. But so anyway, since we can't force our neighbors to close his shop on Sunday or to teach his kids a certain thing, we cannot delegate that power to a politician who then goes and passes a law and say, well, I represent the people, and therefore we now pass a law. All shops have to be closed on Sunday, and all kids have to go to public schools and learn this particular curriculum. So there's the essence, that the proper role of the state is to do only those things by coercion which people themselves can do, and that means only to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens. So with that rule firmly in mind, we come to the gray areas. And if we're not sure about this, so we should always err in the favor of less control. We should always err in favor of going back to using coercion only in the defense of life, liberty, or property, and use that as our final litmus paper test. So that's what the proper...
Because less is more.
Less is more, yeah.
Thank you so much. Look at that. We killed 2 hours handily.
We are definitely going to have you back on. We've got much to talk about.
We could pick your brain for days and days and days.
Well, I don't know. After we get past a couple of points like this, it gets pretty barren. But
I don't think so. Not thinking so. Bill didn't even get as much time on his peace symbol as he wanted.
Well, I'd love to do it. So thanks a lot for all you're doing, and I hope we've...
Well, thank you very much for being on with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
So enjoyable, and we'll shoot you the list of all the songs, because they were awesome. That is our guest, G. Edward Griffin. We are done for today. We will see you next week. Do not miss it. It is geoengineering and fear porn. So if that doesn't get you to tune in, I don't know what will. You're listening to We the People.
You just like saying porn.
I do.